One of the 6,918 children in Wisconsin's foster care system are waiting for placement. It's National Foster Care Month, so Wisconsin Eye is grateful to three people who work in and with the foster care system to talk about that. To my left is Eloise Anderson, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Rachel Peters is a foster care parent who lives in Cross Plains, and her husband Matt is a member of our Wisconsin Eye leadership team. And Dawn Douglas is foster care coordinator for Dane County Department of Human Services. Thanks very much for coming in to talk about a very important subject. Eloise, you have overseen the state foster care system for a little while. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the unique changes, how it has changed? Because you were saying earlier that maybe the governmental systems haven't changed, but the needs have changed. Can you give us an overview?
When I look back at foster care system, what I see is a system that was designed to only deal with kids and families when we remove them. It didn't look at preventing families from coming in. It didn't look at helping families when they were in the system. It was all about removal. And the federal government, since the late 50s, has been supporting taking kids away from their families. One of the things that we've tried to do in Wisconsin is to think differently about that. How do we keep kids at home? How do we get there earlier? Are there ways that we can tell when a family's in crisis and a child is going to be moving out? So we've been trying to, with a very antiquated system, to make the changes. And the changes that we've been trying to make are more family-oriented, either with your biological family or kin family or stranger family, to make it more family-oriented, less institutional care. That's been very difficult because that's not where the money has been. And we've tried to make, when a child is out of their family and out of home, to make that experience for them and for the foster parent more like being the real parent. So we've done a lot of things to give foster parents more ability to raise a child that's not theirs like they would raise their own child. So we've tried to make it both easier for foster parents, mm-hmm. and more family-like for foster kids. In some cases we're winning, in some cases we're not. But it's an antiquated system. And it's a system that was based on volunteer parents, two parents in the household, one staying home, the other one working, so they could take care of another kid. Most of our foster parents both work. It's very difficult to do this work if you both work. So we need to rethink this system. We need to rethink it in terms of the type of children that are coming in who have a lot more trauma than they used to have, and to think it in terms of, can we really expect parents who take on these kids to be working outside the home and do the kind of things that these kids need? So that's what's ahead of us.
Thank you. Don, you work with parents like Rachel and Matt, but I'm curious, can you follow up on something that Eloise said, seeing a lot more trauma? Can you talk about that? Yeah. And then I'll ask Rachel for their experiences about it. So talk to me about the different forces now that requires foster care, please.
Yeah, I think one of the things, when you talk about trauma, we never used to look at that when we were looking at families. We were so quick to label kids with, oh, they've got reactive attachment disorder and so on. And right now, we've learned that their brain development changes if they've been traumatized. And we need to help our foster parents learn about that and then learn about how to, what is informing the behavior and how do you deal with those behaviors. So our initial training has a lot to do with talking about trauma and what happens when kids are traumatized. The trauma for some of our kids, honestly, maybe they've been maltreated, maybe there's drug abuse and so on in the home, mental illness, but a lot of times the trauma is we took them away from their family and what they know. And so that becomes a trauma, and trying to help them learn about that. In all our training materials, they've been redone so that redeveloped so that they do talk about trauma. And I know for us, we actually do trauma-informed parenting classes as ongoing training, where we're training staff, foster parents, and birth parents all in the same training. And so it's quite interesting, and you really get all sides of it at that point.
Rachel, where is the joy of being a foster parent because you and Matt have had more than 20?
Yep, over 20 now. I kind of lose track of the numbers. Sometimes I have to sit down and I'll go back through and list them out. I can usually remember all their names if I think about it.
Where's the joy in, are you seeing different needs on the part of the kids?
Oh, there's such a tremendous amount of variation in their needs, because it depends on their age that they are when they are coming to us. It depends on kind of what the situation is that brought them to us. It depends on if, you know, it happens to be we've done on-call where we're getting kind of an emergency situation in a shorter-term placement, or it depends on if it's a placement that we've kind of gotten information about and then chosen to take on based on that info and the fact that they've kind of looked at us as a possible match for that child. So there's just such a wide variety kind of that we've encountered over the years. So,
But the joy in being a foster parent is where?
The joy, I think.
Or the satisfaction?
The satisfaction is just, I guess, I can think of a story and just our foster son that we are planning to adopt, who is a teenager, that we've taken on. It's been a very eventful year with a lot of ups and downs with him and a lot of time and emotional energy that we've invested into him. But this past Mother's Day, he bought me a gift, and it was very special because we had happened to go into this store to pick out a present for one of his friend's birthday, and I just mentioned wanting wind chimes because my grandparents always had wind chimes and I want to get some for our house. And he remembered that and went back with my husband and picked out some wind chimes for me for Mother's Day. And that, I think that that's just kind of the epitome, those little moments. I think it doesn't come in the big stuff because you can't, you got to focus on the day-to-day because we're encountering so many different things on a day-to-day basis. That wow. It's those little things. It's the hug and the I love you from the little one, and it's the, you know, special Mother's Day gift, and it's the, you know, the good grades that, you know, a child gets. They're just all those different little things, I think, that add up.
Looking in from the outside, they've done their children have really done a nice job of your birth children of embracing foster care, and as a matter of fact, have done some awareness building, and I just think, wow, you're raising good kids, and they really think this is important, and so that I would think would be a joy for you as well.
It is, yeah, to see that, you know, what we're doing is having an impact on the children that we're also raising in bringing in all these other children into our home, I think. Is a huge thing, because I think we do often question throughout the years, throughout the days, the months, you know, is what we're doing a good thing for our family, because it is a hard thing. And so we kind of constantly evaluate, is the good that we're doing for the children we're bringing in outweighing the negative that comes in with it? Or is it kind of, or, you know, are we staying balanced in that?
So. Eloise, the 6,918 that's on your website that are waiting, that are in the foster care system, is there an age cluster for that? Are most of them under six, or how would you break it out by age?
Oh, I think we have maybe a third of them are five and under. A third of them are probably 6 to 13, and then the rest are adolescents. Adolescents is the hardest.
Yes.
Because, you know, they're hard. They're already adolescents, and just in the normal circumstances, adolescence is difficult. And then they come to you with the immediate trauma that they've got from being removed, and then all the baggage that they bring with them, of which you have to unpack and you have to get them to come to grips with. And then they know their parents, their biological parents, who are interacting with them. So it's not like we're taking them away and taking them to Kansas. They're still in the family system, and now they're in a new family system. And one of the things that teenagers always have a problem with is loyalty. And so now we're really forcing those issues for them. And then some of them have been drug affected. Many of the families we're getting now, the children, we're removing the kids because the parents are drug affected. So we got a lot of issues here. And then we have a lot of our kids where one or both of the parents are incarcerated, which is another trauma experience for them. So our kids, I used to say when I first got back into this, you know, when kids were abused, it was a lot easier than this, because this is mostly neglect, which is way more difficult to deal with than physical abuse.
Dawn, what's the average stay in a foster home in Dane County?
So I know for us, I want to say it depends on the age of the child. For younger kids, of course, they're trying to reach permanence, whether that means go home, adoption, or perhaps a guardianship. I want to say it's about 2 years. I know that as we're approaching a year, we're seriously looking at, you know, how realistic is this child going to be able to go back home? And we're hoping to pull in family members and stuff. We've hoped to do that all along.
What percentage of Dane County foster children are eventually returned to their biological?
So in Dane County, I don't have the specific stat, but I want to say it's at least 80% are going to go home or to a relative in Dane County.
Would that also be the statewide?
That would be about the statewide, yeah. One of our big pushes in child welfare is to reunite the family. It's very difficult, but we have two tasks. We have reunification and permanency. Mm-hmm. And sometimes permanency doesn't mean reunification. So you have workers trying really hard to get the family working, and at the same time with an eye out to this might not work. And with substance abusing parents, the time limits that the workers have in front of them are unrealistic for reunification, because by the time you get them to the point where they can handle be without the drug for the first time, relapse occurs, and you don't know when that relapse is going to occur. And one of the things that the child welfare system has to learn is how do we deal with substance abusing families who are addicted. And it's not just going to be heroin. We had cocaine and crack. And the human condition seems to like to go to substance abusing. So as a system, we have to learn how to deal with parents who are addicted, and we have to ask some questions we've never asked. Can we put a kid in a family where the parent is going to be relapsing? And if we can, how do we do that? How do we make that work? We've never asked these questions before. Right. We just take and give the kid to a different family. Right. And you know, when they turn 18, they go back and look for their family who took them away from.
Rachel, it's one thing to become a foster parent. It's another to try to adopt that foster child.
Yeah.
So how does a family, your family, talk about that decision, that huge decision to bring a foster child into a adoption?
I think for us, that's something that's kind of evolved over the years as our family has grown, as Matt and I have aged, and just, you know, I think we have had different goals at different points kind of along our fostering experience. Because I know we do currently, we have a daughter that's adopted from foster care, and when we got licensed by the state in order to, you know, and then we brought her into our family, that was our intention. We really were hoping to adopt. We weren't at that point wanting to simply foster. That was kind of what we wanted to add to our family by adoption, and for us that made sense. And since then, that kind of goal and outlook has shifted a lot. We've been challenged even as we worked with Malaya and her birth family. And even though we kind of all knew it was highly likely adoption would happen with her, we really had the opportunity to see the other side of what it meant to be connected to her birth family and how important that is. And her birth family and us still have a relationship now, even years. Now it's been, let's see, 8 years since she joined our family, you know, and 6 years since we adopted, and I still talk to the birth mom and have a really good relationship with her. And I think, although there are challenges in that, it's also a good thing for our daughter to know her birth family and still have a relationship with them. And that's something that has kind of guided us towards kind of, you know, fostering in different ways then, and fostering and focusing more on reunification and supporting families, and then also still wanting to pursue adoption, partly because we really wanted our daughter to not be the only adopted one. That was something for us as a family that was important. So we kind of had hoped that we would be, you know, end up adopting through fostering again.
How does a potential foster parent, how are they trained? And there's a home inspection. Can we talk the process a little bit, please?
That's changed a lot, too, over the years, yeah, I'll tell you. We are very intrusive, first of all. Very intrusive. Yeah, we say that up front, and we have to be. You're taking mm-hmm. care of our most vulnerable children, and so we really mm-hmm. need to be able to trust you, know you. So they go through a pretty rigorous pre-screening, and during that time, there's some online training that I helped develop, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But online training for foster parents that they do before they get licensed. Then we do something called a safe assessment tool, which actually, if they do end up adopting their foster child, it's the same tool that is used in the adoption process. They just have to add the adoption piece on, and it's the adoption workers have access to it, so it makes it a lot easier for you.
Yeah,
it happens quicker.
That's actually kind of a little bit newer since we originally.
So after you get licensed, you have 2 years to complete 30 hours of foundation training. And so that's based on 9 different modules.
So every parent has to be licensed?
Yep, every parent.
But by the state or by each county? Or
It's a statewide curriculum.
But the counties do it.
And it's actually done through the University of Milwaukee Child Welfare Partnership. They run it, but they run in different sections of the state. And so you could go to the training anywhere in the state. It doesn't have to be in your mm-hmm. county. Dane County, we're lucky. We license enough people every year that we have like 4 sessions a year in Madison. But you have to go through that. It's interactive, held either at night or on weekends.
Okay.
After your first 2 years, you have to have 10 hours of ongoing training per year. And we have different opportunities. We have a trauma-based support group run by one of our foster parents monthly, that she's actually a trainer for the National Child Support Network out of North Carolina. And so she runs a support group, and we actually invite our birth parents that go through the trauma-informed parenting to that as well, to have that extra support. But there's webinar options. We have different options, in terms of face-to-face training that they can go to and in the community.
And a home inspection at some point?
Oh, I'm sorry. During the licensing, when we do the safe tool, we're also doing the home inspection.
What do the financial stipends for being a foster parent depend on the age of the child? Is it greater the younger? How does it work generally?
Go ahead. It depends on, there's a uniform foster care rate statewide based only on ages of children. But we don't just look at their ages. It's pretty low, mm-hmm. actually. We don't just look at their ages. We also look at what their needs are and what we're expecting our foster parents to do. So there's something called a child adolescent needs and strengths tool mm-hmm. that's done on every child and redone every 6 months. And we use that to help base what the rate should be each month. And higher needs of the kid, the higher the rate is.
Okay.
Dane County, I don't know, you could tell me if I'm wrong, but I know in other counties sometimes it's more of an issue about what they're getting paid. Mm-hmm. In Dane County, I remember a TV station wanted to do a story about that because the rates hadn't been raised for a while, mm-hmm. the uniform foster rate. None of our foster parents wanted to go on camera and talk about that because they're like, I'm okay with what we're getting paid. So, and if things come up, that seem to be, there's ways that we can add into, that's another mm-hmm. change that's happened, is that we can do things with the rate to help offset some upcoming costs, mm-hmm. To help them promote normalcy.
But we don't
kids.
Pay the foster parent to do this. We pay for the needs of the child.
Right,
I understand.
Right, okay. It's not an income.
It's not, right,
right.
Mm-hmm. It's voluntary.
Are the needs, Eloise? Are the needs greater in our urban areas, Milwaukee,
no.
Madison?
No, no. I think that's
uniform.
I think our rural areas have. When I look out at the state, I look at it, rural Wisconsin and inner city Milwaukee look a lot alike. Mm-hmm. The only difference is the color of the kids. Mm-hmm. Other than that, if I took the color away and just looked at the kids, they would be the same. And the service systems for the rural area are lacking. Milwaukee and Dane have a variety of services. The cities mm-hmm. have a variety of services. When I get north to the rural areas and the tribes, the service system just fades away.
Fades away.
Fades away. So they're more creative because they have to be, and they try to figure it out. So foster parents, we've got foster parents that I think that when they die, they should be met with
special place.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, Rachel, on that note, If there's a potential foster parent watching this show, what advice would you give she and he?
Don't be afraid to try it. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, and don't be afraid to ask questions. That's something that I run into a lot. People ask a lot of, a whole variety of questions, some appropriate, some not so much, and we deal with those as we need to. But I think that in general, just, you know, don't be afraid to ask questions and just to look into it. Because I think people don't know what all goes into it. People don't know what the support is all out there either. And I think that they shy away from that as opposed to just trying to take the step to find out the
info.
One of
those questions that a potential foster parent might ask is, what if it becomes obvious that this isn't going to work, that it's not a manageable situation for either the child or the foster parent? What happens then?
So if it's a situation where that child's dangerous to someone in the family, we will have that child removed immediately and try and locate a resource for them, another foster home that might be better equipped or have fewer kids or something. Otherwise, we ask them to give us a 30-day notice just to help us try to transition them more. Okay. And to give us some time. Most of our foster parents are really good with that. The other thing is, you know, we have to tell our foster parents everything about the kids coming in. Sometimes we don't know everything, mm-hmm. but we have to tell them. It's not in our interest to say, oh, we're not going to tell them this. Sorry about that. Not going to tell them about this. They won't take the kid. Mm-hmm. We don't want to do that because we care about our foster parents, right. You know, and we want to build relationships with them so they stay with us for a while.
Also, there's a lot of work done to make the match, to make the match good. So it's not often that occurs. But I was a recipient of one that fell apart, and she was an adolescent when I got her, and I said, okay, I'll do the temporary thing, right? Mm-hmm. Temporary thing being until she turned 18. And she's still in my life. So, you know, they don't leave. They become yours. I mean, they become yours.
They become yours.
I think the reality, too, is that even if you do have all the information, mm-hmm. you don't know how it's going to work until they're actually there. And I think the reality is that unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't, you know, and like I mentioned, you know, we constantly evaluate when we take kiddos in, you know, is the good we're doing that child outweighing, you know, all the negative impact it might be having on all the other kids in the home, whether our birth or adopted or, you know, our other foster children or ourselves, you know, and our marriage. You know, and the reality is that sometimes we do have to make a tough decision, you know, and you can't be afraid to do that. And I don't think that Dane County, you know, makes you afraid to do that. I think everybody knows that if it's not working, you know, they want what's best for everyone. And the reality is you want the needs of that particular child to be met. And if you can't meet them in their home for whatever reason, you know, then you do have to, you know, look at a different, you know, option.
I understand.
And I think that's the reality. And I think everybody knows that, even though the goal is to have children move around as little as possible.
Right.
Yeah. You know.
We're almost out of time. Maybe a final question for you, Eloise. The challenges and the potential solutions to foster care system in the future, can you look out for the next few years,
please? I think
please?
Our biggest challenge is congregate care. The federal government doesn't want us to do it the way we've been doing it, so we had to think of how to do this differently. And so I think it's going to be a big challenge for us, because when we don't have foster parents, especially for adolescents, we tend to go to group homes, and that's going to be a thing of the past. Okay. And so how we rethink this is going to be real important.
And Rachel, you've enjoyed, love being a foster parent, even with all the challenges?
Yes, definitely.
And
definitely
Dawn,
loved it.
You've done it for decades because why?
Yes. You know what? This is truly my passion. I've done other things in child welfare, but I love foster parents. I love trying to help them feel, you know, important and that we need them. And, it's my passion.
Thank you. It's National Foster Care Month. Mm-hmm. I want to thank Secretary Eloise Anderson, Rachel Peters, and Dawn Douglas for talking about a very important subject. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.